You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome back to the DMZ, everybody.
So it is Thursday morning. We are about 36 hours from Pennsylvania 18. I heard some rumblings of a recount. I don't know if they're really serious. And Rick Saccone, who lost, presumably lost, is already planning to run in a different district for November because they just redrew the Pennsylvania map. This Pennsylvania 18 actually vanishes in thin air for this year. So I don't know how much sense it makes for them to spend a lot of time on a recount when this is so ephemeral. And the big thing is the psychological blow. Even if somehow you want a recount 6 weeks from now, you already have Republicans in office who are saying to themselves, man, if a district Trump won by 20 is essentially a dead heat race, and there are 119 other districts that are less conservative than this one, why don't I go get a nice cushy lobbying job and save myself the agony of this year?
Yeah, I think we're going to see more of that. I've already seen a lot of retirements, you know, and I think we're probably going to see more. If you're on the fence about whether or not to stay in this thing, this is one more data point that says, get out while the getting out is good.
So you wrote a piece about Pennsylvania 18. I wrote a piece about Pennsylvania 18. Your piece was what Republicans should take away from this, and my piece was what Democrats should take away from this. I mean, if you were counseling an incumbent Republican, would you say to them, yeah, you should go cash out?
It depends on the district. It depends on the incumbent. First, let me make a point about an observation that's somewhat related that I made on Twitter, and it seemed to take off a little bit. It's that these Republicans are weird. A lot of them. They're not like when I looked at Connor Lamb and Doug Jones. They seem more like me than Saccone and. Is that right, Saccone?
I think it's Saccone.
And Roy Moore. I mean, granted, this is a weird. The Republican Party now is becoming a little bit weird, and it's the party of like Seb Gorka's a weird guy. I just feel like there's a lot of these weird people, and then the Democrats are getting these kind of fresh, authentic non-politicians.
Well, let's say two things. One, I wouldn't put Saccone in the same category as Moore. He seems like a relatively normal guy.
Maybe. There's nothing like bizarrely weird about him. But I'm just sort of going off of like the perception, the kind of the TV image.
Yeah.
Like he just sort of looks like a Republican politician. Mm-hmm. And the Lamb guy, obviously looks more fresh.
Yeah. I mean, I think Saccone looked like a politician. He didn't seem like a crazy person.
Well, politicians in and of them, but looking like a politician is weird in and of itself. But yeah, okay. Point well taken.
Now, my other point I'd say there is I think Lamb is a consummate politician.
Well, he may be so good that he doesn't seem like a politician.
I mean, I think it was sort of mildly clipped. But a lot of people are looking at the fact that he was a veteran, 33-year-old Marine veteran. And you might recall I wrote a piece last year about the Democratic obsession with veterans because it's nothing new for Democrats to field a large slate of veterans. They do that every cycle, and they almost always lose. And that's not because veterans are bad. They're not losing because they are veterans, but it's yet to be this magical ingredient to flip districts. I personally believe what Lamb brought to the table is that he is from a politician's family. His grandfather was a state senate leader. His uncle, I think, was a prosecutor. His name had currency in that area, and he certainly comes from a family that knows how to run campaigns. He wasn't coming in like an amateur or a novice. I agree with you. He didn't come across like a robot. But having that experience is important too.
The other thing too is, I mean, it's entirely possible that that Doug Jones and Connor Lamb will become boring like politicians once they actually have to. You know what I mean? Mm. like, I might have said the same thing, like, maybe there might have been a time when I thought, like, Tom Cotton's a breath of fresh air, you know what I mean? Like, but these guys, the system has a way of turning them into weird people,
yeah,
into politicians, and so maybe, like, that's going to happen. And, you know, in the case of Connor Lamb, you know, he's got the youthful, fresh, you know, good-looking kind of thing. That's going to – we all get older. You know what I mean? And sometimes we become caricatures of of ourselves. So, look, I mean – but my main point is I do think that Democrats – I mean, this is just an anecdotal slice of their candidates. But it does feel to me like they're running people who even I as a – admittedly center-right conservative guy, I feel more like I would have a beer with Doug Jones and Connor Lamb than the Republicans. And I don't know if that is a microcosm of a larger trend, but if it is, then look, I think that the political environment's the big story. It's a toxic political environment. That's the big story. But there's a subplot here about the quality of candidates. And if Jones and Lamb are a harbinger of things to come, that's part of the story.
I want to make a point about that, but before I do, I want to make a different tangential point. Have you seen the new John Tester ad?
Yes.
So it was John Tester, he's senator from Montana.
He holds up the eight fingers.
Right. He's seven fingers. So John Tester, he's been there. He's a two-term senator from Montana. He's a Democrat. He's never won 50%. He's won both races with pluralities. But he's always been able to give off this persona of a regular guy, buzz cut, runs the family farm. And when he was 9 years old, he lost three fingers in a meat grinder accident on his family's cattle farm, you know, shoving meat into a meat grinder. So he has this sort of physical evidence that he's not some, you know, blow dried politician, but he's running for his third term. He still runs the farm, but he effectively lives in D.C., and I believe his son goes to school in D.C. So, I mean, there's always the risk when you're running that many times that you get accused of going native. So here's his first big ad in the race. He's on a Montana street. His first line in the ad is, Washington's a mess, as if, like, he's never been there. He's sort of stumbled into the place, and it's a disaster. But he wants to prove that he hasn't wasted his time there. He ticks off all the bills that he has sponsored that Trump has signed. So it's not an anti-Trump ad. He's not running as a member of the resistance. And as he and his constituents are counting off his bills and they get to bill number 8, he holds up his two hands and said, I've run out of fingers, with a big smile on his face. He still has, I mean, maybe it's not going to work. Maybe people are going to say, you know, you're trying to snow me, but just looking at the ad in a vacuum, he's still that regular guy. He's still that guy that lost three fingers in a meat grinding accident.
I agree. It's an interesting point, which is to say that perception is reality. And there are certain people who feel like regular guys, and it doesn't matter if they live in New York and make millions of dollars, or if they live in D.C., or if they've been – there's certain people who, like, just ooze kind of Joe six-pack authenticity. And you could say, like, this is crazy. He worked at Goldman Sachs, and he went to Harvard, and he clerked on the Supreme. You can go through all those steps, and it's like, yeah, but I'd like to have – it seems like a regular guy to me. Like, at some point, that's all that matters. And I think that John Tester has that. And I don't think any amount of, like, facts and evidence will actually counter the fact that he, like, looks and feels like a regular average Joe.
So Tester, Connor Lamb, Doug Jones, to some degree, they all seem like regular, normal guys. But it's a different strain of regular, normal guy than Donald Trump, who, if you ask Trump fans, will say, that guy's like me. That's the guy I want to have a beer with. That's the no bullshit guy that's going to go, you know, get things done. And that kind of regular guy, I imagine, still has currency with more conservative parts of the country. But it seems to be a harder model to replicate.
Well, what I'm curious about, let's put a pin in that. I'm curious on who gets to stay a regular guy, because I think getting to stay a regular guy is ironically a privileged position. And what I mean by that is that people who come from very modest beginnings. My dad was a prison guard for 30 years. Marco Rubio's dad was a bartender, you know. Mm-hmm. We have to fight to kind of break into the establishment or the system. And we get mentors, and like I used to mispronounce all sorts of words. Creek was crick. Water was water. There's one that there was one that was really sort of pervasive figure was figure.
Now, is that a Western Maryland thing?
I don't know. I don't know if this is like just a colloquial, you know, rural colloquialism so we have to sort of play this game to fit in and to try to like succeed. And what are the rules, right? When I first started working in DC, Bill, at the age of 24, the first guy who hired me in my real job was a guy named John Donegan. I'm still friends with him. He's a great guy. He could verify this story. He had to tell me that you don't button all the buttons on your sports coat. So like if I had a 3-button or a 2-button sports jacket or suit coat, I would button all the buttons, because no one ever told me you don't do that. You know what I mean? So I had to kind of learn, and you're like, how do I fit in? I think if you're someone like a Donald Trump, for example, you don't have to go through that stage of changing and evolving. You sort of have the luxury of the privilege of like just letting your freak flag fly in the way that you want to. I don't know what the version of that is for someone like a tester, or I think there's something here. There's a think piece here to be written. I just haven't quite figured it out. I'll throw it out to the commenters, and maybe you have a thought on this.
A thought on
privilege of getting the privilege of not having to be. I don't want to say that people like me and Rubio are co-opted, but but I think that we have to sort of play by some rules and adapt.
So you think there's a risk of inauthenticity because you are removing yourself from your natural element, whereas a Trump has always been where he is?
Well, there's this interesting irony too, right? And I think this is in Too Dumb to Fail. Maybe this might have gotten cut out. I know this was in – you may have told me to cut this out. But there's an interesting story where Muhammad Ali – who is this middle class mulatto, you know, sort of middle class kid, I think from Kentucky.
Yeah.
And he's fighting Joe Frazier, mm-hmm. the son of a sharecropper, mm-hmm. who grew up on the mean streets of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And Joe Frazier becomes the Uncle Tom in that fight.
Right.
And Muhammad Ali, you know, later, I guess, against Foreman goes to Zaire and
right.
singing the Ali Bumba.
Well, yeah, right.
Ali becomes the authentic mm-hmm. African American mm-hmm. hero, mm-hmm. and Joe Frazier, mm-hmm. the son of a sharecropper mm-hmm. from the mean streets of Philadelphia, becomes this Uncle Tom sellout.
Yeah,
it's exactly the opposite of what it should have been, mm-hmm. based on their biography, based on the authenticity. But Ali understood how to present himself mm-hmm. in a way. And maybe that speaks to the Conor Lamb thing, mm-hmm. The privilege of coming from a certain family. By the way, I'm gonna co-opt the privilege thing. Is that just white privilege? There's mm-hmm. other privilege too, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and so I think that there's like an authenticity privilege.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, a George Bush can go to Kennebunkport or his Crawford Ranch because they have the means to own compounds like that, and no one thinks much of it. And if you're someone that came from a more humble background, like a Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, you don't have a vacation compound to go to.
Yeah.
Then people start mocking you that you're going to Martha's Vineyard or whatever and renting places. And how much money are you spending on renting those places? How dare you spend that kind of money on renting places? You know, when you're upwardly mobile, people challenge your bona fides.
People won't believe this, but I was mocked for being a redneck. So I had to learn to talk like the man on the 6 o'clock news.
Right. You get it both ways. Well,
real quick, a complete sidebar here, but you mentioned compound. Yeah. I'm in the middle of watching the Chappaquiddick movie.
Oh, really?
Right now. I got a screener of it.
Wow.
And it's pretty good. I'm halfway through. We'll check back next week.
But I want to get back to your column, though. So,
all right.
So I hear you that Republicans are in trouble because Democrats seem to have a good field of recruits to ooze authenticity, although we haven't seen the rest of them yet, but they seem to be doing pretty good so far. So what do you tell a Republican today? What do you tell them to do?
So if I'm advising a Republican incumbent and he's thinking about retiring, he's in a tough district, get out. Get out while the getting's good. Pull the ripcord. There's not going to be you. Go ahead. If I'm advising sort of a regular Republican, I think what I tell them is, and this should be what leadership is telling them, that we are cutting you loose to the extent that we can. I mean, Donald Trump is going to go on Twitter and attack you, so good luck with that. But as far as I'm concerned, you should do what you need to do to survive. If you survive by hugging Donald Trump, hug Donald Trump. If you survive by attacking Donald Trump, attack Donald Trump. If you survive by praising Donald Trump on some things and attacking Donald Trump on others, do that. The other thing I think Republicans ought to do, and this is one of my sources, the wrong word, because it's not like I'm being leaked information here, but it's just someone I check in with who's a smart Republican operative for just sort of like what should Republicans be doing, says they got to pass infrastructure. Like,
good luck with that.
Well, you want to be able to talk about local, you know, Democrats are nationalizing this race, right? And so, well, in some ways, they're localizing
it.
Well,
I mean, Lamb was not beating up on Trump.
If you're, okay, fair point. If you're a local Republican incumbent, you want to be able to talk about the new bridge that you're putting in, about how those people up in Washington, again, this is taking a page from John Tester. Mm-hmm. The people up in Washington, they don't know what they're doing, but I'm bringing a bridge or the new highway to the district, whatever it is. That's probably what you have to do, right? See, maybe your only chance for survival.
But it seems like the tough question is, if you're not quitting, do you hug Trump or do you run away from Trump in this environment? So, I mean, the run away from Trump argument would be, we're getting killed. We're getting killed in these. Even if we win the special, we're winning with pretty weak turnouts. So, you know, Trump couldn't get Roy Moore over the line. Couldn't get Rick Scott over the line. You know, there's some Trump base, but clearly not enough. So I need to do something else to get folks in the middle. And the other argument is, the only thing we have going for us is Trump. Is his ability to juice the base. And maybe if Dakota Moore couldn't do it.
It's like a drug, right? Right. It's a catch-22, and it's also it's like you're doing something that's, you know, long-term is going to kill you, but, like, in the short term, maybe you have to do it just to, like, get by. Look, if Donald Trump could come to your district, okay, if you're in a – if you're a Republican incumbent, and Donald Trump could come to your district the day before the election, I'd probably say do it. But outside of that, you know, going back to the Joe Trippi podcast, I had him on my show recently, and he said that in Alabama, Trump came to Pensacola, and Roy Moore goes up 4 points, and it dissipates over the next 3 or 4 days. Donald Trump went to Pittsburgh, right, the Saturday before the election. I think if he'd gone on the Monday, I'd be very curious to see what would have happened, actually. Maybe that, Maybe they should have paid attention to that. Well, look, this is obviously not scalable. You know, you can't you can't visit, you know, 100 congressional districts on Monday, the Monday before the midterm elections. But I do think, and again, I get that presidents are busy, but in hindsight, I would love to see what would have happened if he had gone on Monday, you know, based on what Trippi told me.
Although I imagine he'll be on the trail. He's not going to be that busy at home. There's not going to be a lot of legislation to work on. And he seems to like doing the rallies more than almost anything else, you know, short of, you know, going golfing.
Yeah, but the rallies don't, I mean, the rallies don't work unless, you know, again, I'm basing this solely off of Trippi's, internal mm-hmm. tracking mm-hmm. polls.
Well, right? whether they're a good idea or not, I mean, you know, Obama went on the stump in 2010. Bill Clinton went on the stump in 1994. I mean, there's just a general desire for a president to feel like they're doing all they can and they're saving a party that's in trouble. And yeah. And Trump, even more than most, is not going to be coachable to say, look, guy, it's better if you just stay home here. He's going to go because he wants to go. So even if you want to distance yourself from Trump, you might have a hard time doing it because he's going to be in the news that whole stretch in the fall.
Yes. And that actually speaks to the media environment, right? In the olden days, you know, if the president, well, first of all, in the olden days, a president would be like, do you want me to come or not? You know, no, don't come. Okay, I won't. But also in the olden days, I think that if you lived in Pittsburgh, let's say, you would probably be much more in tune with what's happening locally, what's happening in Harrisburg or what's happening, you know, in Pittsburgh. Like, you know, you wouldn't necessarily be getting the national news, at least certainly not 24/7 cable mm-hmm. and Twitter. And so it's probably harder now to localize a race, even if you want to, even if you diligently work hard to localize a race and have people not focus on the national scene. It's probably super hard to pull that off. Maybe impossible.
Well, let me shift to the Democrats. As you can see, my thoughts on that over at Politico. The title, the column is "Why Conor Lamb Probably Won." And so, obviously, the short story is this is just good for Democrats.
By the way, Bill, I had written two columns. I had on Tuesday night. I had a column if Lamb wins and if Saccone wins. And damned if they didn't mess up both of those columns.
You know, do you usually pre-write before elections?
No, but in this case I did because actually my thesis was going to be, the general thesis was going to be the same either way. Whether Saccone won by 1 point or lost by a point, it was going to be a harbinger of bad things to come for Republicans. So I could basically write one column that was my thesis, but I just sort of topped it with a different, you know, like a different little bit, a different spin. That way it would just be ready to go. So I wasn't going to change my opinion based on what happened. It was just like, we could put this up. And then of course I wrote two columns taking into account the two possible scenarios and neither of them were applicable in a race that we didn't know who actually had won.
Yeah, you know, I've only been doing, you know, quick turnaround pieces recently. I didn't, you know, I wasn't, you know, working for a publication who asked for that sort of thing. But since I have, and it's clear that it's become commonplace to pre-write stuff because they want pieces up, you know, within, you know, 2 minutes yeah. of things being called. And I don't have that assignment, but I still have to write pretty quickly. I just don't like pre-writing because, I find if whatever thoughts I have beforehand, they might be okay thoughts, but they're probably not super original thoughts. And I prefer, you know, checking Twitter in the immediate aftermath to see what everybody else is saying to make sure I'm not just repeating what everybody else is saying.
All right, now let me ask you a question. What time did you go to bed Tuesday night?
3 a.m.
I was asleep at 11.
That the downside of my strategy is I don't get any sleep, but it's also my one time where I'm all by myself. Yeah. There's nothing but tranquility around.
Well, no, it did work out for me because. So first of all, I just want to be clear. I didn't write this days in advance. I basically wrote the column as the polls are closing, and I had a pretty good sense that it was going to be a very tight race. And then, as I'm still writing the column, 50% of the vote is in, and it's neck and neck.
Yeah.
So I basically, you know, I was assuming that they might call the race by like 9:30 or 10.
Yeah.
You know, because the polls closed at 8 Eastern. Mm-hmm. So I would have been ready to rock and roll. I ended up going to sleep, waking up the next morning around 6 a.m., rejiggering it a little bit based on what we knew at the time. But I'm fresh. At this point, I'm fresh. I've got 8 hours of sleep. I'm drinking a pot of coffee. And I'm getting a second look. Nothing better than to leave a column, come back.
Yeah.
Like the next morning, and like, well, I can't believe I thought that. So that's kind of how I did it. But I got a good night's sleep that night.
You beat me on that score. So anyway, so the obvious take is good for Democrats. Blue waves come in. Republicans are screwed. How could they? If a Democrat could win here, they could win anywhere. But there is this debate that continues on the left over how best to run. Should Democrats be kind of leaning right, depending on the district, to pick off those swing voters and Trump voters, or should they go hard left? I mean, there's a strong belief on the Bernie-crat left that his positions, single payer, $15 minimum wage, positions on trade, that these cut across party lines, and if someone is running as an they make the authenticity argument. If you're running as an authentic progressive populist, that's going to be better than some cookie cutter, you know, establishment recruit who's tacking to the winds. And Connor Lamb, so you know, Bernie-crats got their guy in Montana, Rob Quist, who did better than Hillary but still lost. And John Ossoff, who was more of a moderate, he lost. And so a lot of the folks left said, don't run more John Ossoffs. That's a disaster. But then Ralph Northam wins in Virginia, who beat the Bernie endorsed Tom Perriello in the primary, Northam being a former Republican. Doug Jones wins in Alabama, who wasn't, you know, a super blue dog. He stuck to his guns on pro-choice and climate science, but he wasn't single payer. I don't think he was $15 minimum wage. He wasn't talking about revolution. He was talking about working across the aisle.
Common ground.
That's,
I'm telling you, there's got to be some sort of Frank Luntz focus group that the Democrats have about finding common ground.
And Connor Lamb ran that way as well.
I'm hearing that line specifically. Not the idea. I mean, the idea has been around forever, but finding common ground. There's something that must be testing very well.
Yeah. So, you know, so Connor Lamb early in the race said $15 minimum wage, that sounds high based on the small businesses that I talk to. And he got a little guff from unions in the area about that. He never embraced single payer. You may have seen there was this controversy a few weeks ago after the D-Trip, using D-Trip the way you like
D-Trip.
It. D-Trip, you know, ran that oppo dump on Laura Moser over in Texas 7. Then suddenly these leaks of D-Trip memos come out. They're designed to rile the left and stoke more anger at the DCCC. One of them was this healthcare polling memo suggesting, fixing and improving the Affordable Care Act polls better than single payer. You know, they didn't put quite in those terms. They say what polls best are these improvements to current law that does better than radical change. And then they only talk about single payer as it being a political liability. Connor Lamb runs on that message. He does not embrace single payer. He talks about the Affordable Care Act is making progress. It has its flaws. Let's build on the progress. So because of those things, all the big progressive groups that are playing in primaries Democracy for America, Progressive Change Campaign Committee, Justice Democrats, Our Revolution, which is the Bernie founded group. They don't endorse Lamb. Now, the DCCC does. And the labor unions do. So labor unions, they get over what Carl Lamb said about $50 minimum wage, because Lamb is talking about union rights generally. Rick Saccone is for anti-union right to work laws. The prior Republican in that district was against right to work laws. This is a lunch bucket, lunch pail area. A lot of union workers. They might be culturally conservative, but they're still in the union. So the previous Republican adhered to that dynamic and Saccone didn't. Conor Lamb exploited that to his effect. And Conor Lamb was very strong for Social Security and Medicare. You saw Paul Ryan yesterday say, oh, they ran a conservative. Conor Lamb literally has an ad where he attacks Paul Ryan by name for trying to gut Social Security and Medicare.
Let me just ask you quickly. There does seem to be an attempt to spin the race to say, hey, there's no problem, nothing to see here. This guy ran, the Democrat won, but he ran as a Donald Trump Republican, so this is actually a good sign.
Well,
what's the point of doing that?
There was a guy from the NRCC who tweeted, look, this guy was able to attack right because he didn't have a primary. No one on his left was tugging at him to go left, and so he could be for gun rights, and he could talk about working with Trump, working across the aisle, and not get any guff for it. And there is some truth to that. But it's also true that he was for Social Security and Medicare. He attacked Paul Ryan by name. He expressed, even they said he was personally pro-life, but he supported Roe v. Wade. He brandishes assault rifle in his first ad, so he loves to shoot. And he's not for an assault weapons ban, but he did say it was for universal background checks. So it's a bridge too far
Was that ad before Parkland?
The ad was before Parkland. After Parkland, he didn't abandon his basic view. He said, I'm still against an assault weapons ban. But he did come out for universal background checks after Parkland. That's the one, I think, adjustment. I mean, I don't know if he said something before, I'm not aware of it, but he was asked about after Parkland. And he said that much. It's a bridge too far to say he ran as a conservative. I mean, you could say he did not run to the hard left. You know, he's not single payer. He's not $15 minimum. But that's not the same as I'm essentially a Republican with a D next to my name. Mm-hmm. He embraced Trump on tariffs, but that's an issue that does cut across party lines at this point. There are people on both sides of the issue in both parties. So what you're left with is a guy who was, I'd say, running populist light, taking some cues from the D-trip and some cues from the progressive left. But the professional progressive left sat it out because they felt he wasn't progressive enough. The unions help him out, and the D-trip helps him out, and he makes it. So how do you add all that up to say, what does this tell us about how other Democrats should run? I think it's a bridge too far to say everything that the progressive populist left wants is a bust. There may be other districts where being for single payer would be fine. It wasn't disproven, but the flip side is the folks on the left saying, don't listen to the DCCC. Don't listen to their cautious, poll-tested mush, because mm-hmm. that's not authentic enough, and you can't juice the base with that. Well, that has been disproven. You can win with that.
Isn't this, ironically, an argument for the free market, the invisible hand, and federalism?
On policy or in politics?
Politics. What I'm saying is, you don't want central planning to say, this is what a Democratic nominee is supposed to look like or say. You want to let the market figure that out. In each place, it's going to be a little different. Conor Lamb, like Doug Jones, can win in Alabama, but not Massachusetts. Elizabeth Warren can win in Massachusetts, but not in Texas. Or what, you know?
This is why it doesn't quite work, because the free market part of the process. The NRCC is right. Lambden out of a primary. I'm not quite sure how he became the only one in the race. If the D-Trip engineered that, or Lamb engineered that, or just no one else showed up. I don't know. But in Houston, in Texas 7, for example, Houston area, if you just leave it to the market, leave it to the wind to the side, you can't be confident, because the marketplace, the consumers who are buying the product on election day, are not necessarily reflective of the district as a whole. It's not in a normal marketplace. You have, days and months and years of consumer data to figure out, okay, what product am I going to push on the shelves and what my price point's going to be. You got one day, one time, and the people that show up in the store that day might be a skewed pool of people and might actually choose a product that's not going to go off the shelves come November when there's a bigger pool of consumers.
I agree with you, and this is a much larger, this speaks to my whole concern about political parties outsourcing candidate selection to primaries, because that has the same problem.
So to your point earlier, to the extent that Lamb and Jones are good recruits, I don't know exactly how they got in the race. I don't know if I can credit all that to people in Washington doing the recruiting, but there is some at least good evidence that someone's out there finding people who are good fits for their district and state without putting an ideological filter on that decision. And the progressive populist argument, which is our suite of issues is the secret sauce to flipping districts, that is at minimum not proven yet.
Right.
And I don't have a strong sense that they have figured out how to recruit good people who would help them make that argument. They seem to be taking whoever they can get off the street who's willing to run that race. So here you are, you have Laura Moser in Houston. The Dietrich's overt point, the left will say they just want to box her up because of her positions. The Dietrich's point is, no, she has this thing on her record where she disparages Paris, Texas, that's going to make her a bad general election candidate. If you're doing good recruiting, you vet that thing in advance, and if that person doesn't vet, you find somebody else.
This is very analogous to what Republicans went through, when Barack Obama was president, and Republicans had the wind at their back in the midterms, and you had people like Marco Rubio and Pat Toomey and Jeff Flake, but you also had people like Sharon Angle and Christine O'Donnell and Danny Tarkanian, who's back again. I guess there's a interestingly, it seems that the people who are the most ideologically committed, there's an inverse relationship between competence, or at least a focus on competence, and the focus on ideological purity. It's a rare organization that looks at both. I think a group like the Club for Growth, actually, although you could certainly point to some bad endorsements, but factoring in, these people need to be good on our issues, but they also have to be, legit, not crazy, experience, that kind of thing.
Well, there's this one criteria that the DCCC has, which is we want to know if you can run that you are running a professional campaign, that you have the ability, as one person told me, that you have a story to tell and have a means to tell that story. That's the DCCC really looks for. There is a memorandum of agreement that they have with candidates that says you're going to use consultants that come from our comprehensive list of choices. And there are people on the left that have seen that memo leaked out, and they said, this is a racket. The D-Trip just wants to funnel money to their consultant friends, and they don't even care if you win or lose, because it's just about making money. And I haven't seen the list.
Same exact thing happens on the right and the Republican Party. Blacklist people that they don't like, and they hook up friends and former colleagues. I can just tell you now, because my wife is a Republican fundraiser, and there was a there's a current, you know, conservative Republican U.S. senator who was running, and my and signed my wife to be his fundraiser, and this guy gets a call from, you know, Central Command that basically says, you know, if you want the support of us in Washington, you need to hire this other person, you know, you need to hire this other fundraiser.
Well, if you,
who
if,
happens to be very good friends with or related to or married to somebody who is or used to be part of the committee, you know, that kind of thing.
I mean, if it is literally you have to hire this particular person, or I got three people who are okay and everybody else sucks, that's more fishy to me. Again, I haven't seen this list, so I don't know. But if it is like, here are 100 people, here are all the people that essentially a professional consultant, it's like, that's not a racket. That is, I just want some evidence that, yeah, you're not winging this thing before we invest lots of our resources.
I get that, too. I mean, look, if I'm a party committee and I've got candidates who are hiring some local yokel who runs like a t-shirt design firm to run their campaign, or some slick talking person talk them into hiring them and paying them $10,000 a month for consulting. Like, that happens all the time too. So I see it both ways. I definitely think there's a lot of cronyism and kickbacks, by the way. Cronyism, kickbacks, and feathering your own nest, hooking up friends, and the guy who used to run the committee now all of a sudden gets all the business. That happens. But the other problem exists as well, where you've got candidates who are like political novices and they hire bad advisors. And why on earth should a committee or an organization support them financially if they're going to just blow it on bad consultants? So I get it, but I get the criticism too.
So just to circle back to the ideological point, we're not going to settle who's got the better ideological argument because of Pennsylvania 18. I think it is more evidence in favor of tailoring candidates to the district, which I think is more of the D-Trip's approach. It's not D-Trip's not, I'm anti-populist. They just want good fits to the district. I mean, Lamb threw Nancy Pelosi under the bus. Nancy Pelosi effectively chooses who runs the DCCC. You know, they could have very easily said, you're not going to vote for Pelosi.
Well, by the way, let's say Democrats take back the House, which I think is probably a better than 50-50 proposition at this point. What happens to Nancy?
Well, you know, I know there's a piece in Axios today suggesting that she's in trouble.
I sent you that in our pre-planning for this.
Yes, you deserve credit for that, sir. but before I answer that question, it's notable that the DCCC said, I don't care, Connor Lamb, that you're throwing Pelosi under the bus. You're the best shot in this district, and we're going to give you money. They could have very easily said, look, it is a criteria that you're going to back our leader to get our money, and they did not do that. Maybe it's because there actually was a change in the D-Trip's rules, where it used to be that Pelosi literally handpicked the nominee picked the person to run the DCCC, and there's a bit of a revolt, and she said, fine, this can be a vote of the caucus. But they voted for her pick, so it didn't change who it was. But technically speaking, he doesn't literally answer to her in a way that it's Congressman Luan, in a way they did before. But still, it's still her guy. And if she was going to complain about that, I imagine she would have. But it does raise the question, is this going to become a trend that more and more people are going to say, I'm not going to vote Pelosi for leader? I'm not quite sure Lamb is actually taken it that far where it's an ironclad pledge. I mean, think people have interpreted it that way, and if he did vote for Pelosi for speaker, he'd probably get criticized for it.
I saw him on Morning Joe yesterday, Wednesday morning, and he just was just sort of dodging the question.
Well, that does make me think that he might well vote for Pelosi for speaker. I mean, his comment was, we need new leadership in both parties.
Yeah, yeah.
Which gives you a little bit of wiggle room on the actual vote. And maybe that's what the DCCC didn't make too much of it. So, Pelosi is a hell of a head counter, as was mentioned in that Axios piece. She's a hell of a fundraiser. And once
she's a pro, man, you can't take that away.
And she's up there in age, which also is an evidence that she will eventually go. She's not going to be until she's 92, you know. So if you do one more dance with her in 2019, 2020, you know, what's the big deal? You already won the House.
Nancy P.
I mean, the worry is that she will make it so you can't win the House. If you're going to win the House anyway, who cares? Keep her around.
Well, and I have to say, I don't know how old she is, but...
She's 78, I believe.
How old?
78.
So she's a... You know, I'm sure she's had maybe a little work done. She looks great. She looks 60. So she's a young.
Well, I mean, I think this is true when it comes to
78.
Yeah,
it's amazing. She's a young, very young 78.
When it comes to Trump, when it comes to Biden, when it comes to Bernie, when it comes to Warren, these are all folks who are. I think if Warren's not over 70, I think she will be over 70.
Where I come from, you tell me if this is. Where you come from, Bill Scherer, but where I come from, if, you know, circa the 1980s in my area, if you were 78, you were probably in a nursing home. You had been smoking a carton of Marlboro Reds for the last 60 years, a day or a week. You might have been working on in a plant or a factory, or, you know, you're 50 to 75 pounds overweight, maybe 100. 78 ain't what it used to be. And there's rich 78. You know, there's it's like Jack Donaghy said that don't worry, Lemon, he's business drunk or rich drunk. There's rich 78 where you do Pilates and play tennis. Right. Very different than working class.
I think what matters at the end of the day is how you present. If you look and you got the energy, then the age doesn't literally matter. Now, if you fall down on the stage or you repeat yourself three times because your short-term memory is blown, you know, that's gonna be a bad look. But Pelosi, Biden, Bernie, Warren, they don't do that. They come across very, very energetic.
And so, even Trump, although he is... You know, he's an interesting cat, but he's energetic. You can't take that away. I mean, the guy has energy. Now, I believe that it's because he doesn't exercise and he husbands the energy from not exercising. Clearly, that's what's helped, but he's got energy.
Well, so to go back to your question, would Pelosi survive after this? What I think is going to happen is, and it's been reported that the DCCC is now doing a fresh round of recruiting to some folks who are on the fence about running. In more conservative areas, they can now go back to them and say, look what just happened in Pennsylvania 18. You can do this. We can help you. So you might get more Connor Lamb style candidates in the redder, you know, high hanging fruit districts. I think you'll also, I expect the progressive populist left is going to get some nominees of their own too. I don't think it's going to be a one-size-fits-all proposition as far as the field of candidates are concerned. But you might get a handful more of people who are going to do what Lamb did and say, I won't commit to voting for Pelosi for Speaker. Once, assuming Democrats win, Pelosi's going to do her head count. She's going to find out how much she needs. And when she gets to what she needs, she's going to say to some folks in the redder areas, you know what, I don't need you. You're free to, you know, do your protest vote because I have the votes that I need. And there are certain folks like Kyra Lamb where she says, I know what you said, but I really need your vote here. And if you do this, we're going to be in such disarray. It's going to be very hard to function.
Now, do you think Donald Trump would do that? Would Donald Trump tell people, you go, you do what you need to do. I don't need you on this one.
I mean, I don't think Donald Trump has that level of interest in the legislative process to even get to that point.
You know, here's what I think would happen. Donald Trump's somebody, John Kelly or Paul Ryan, would tell people, do what you need to do. We don't need you. And they would do it. And then Trump would go on Twitter and attack them as enemies of the state. Failing Matt Lewis. By the way, I mean, I think it's the zeitgeist right now, but I was thinking about this. If I hadn't been political, if I hadn't been publicly outspoken in my politics, if I wanted to run for public office today, I think I would run as a conservative Democrat.
This is a big shift for Matt Lewis.
I wouldn't change my views, but right. I think like if I were going
to
run,
you would try to be the last standing pro-life Democrat. You'd be the John Bel Edwards of the party.
I think what if so? So I went to college in West Virginia. My wife's from West Virginia.
Okay,
you know,
Joe Manchin Democrat.
I don't know. I mean, it is trending Republican, but I just feel like right this year, my mom lives in Pennsylvania, you know, this year, it feels like the year, I mean, it's like 2006 all over again, Heath Shuler, you know. Right.
But you would go super rogue. You wouldn't commit to Pelosi.
No.
You wouldn't commit to voting for Democratic judges.
No.
So what in
it'd be like, it would be like, you know what, Bill, we need to find common ground. That's what it would be.
would that be the one thing that would say I'm going to run as a Democrat? Is there a certain policy issue where you say I actually agree with my other fellow Democrats on this, or is it just to say I'm a common ground person?
I mean, look, you know, I came out for some common sense gun
right.
stuff.
So you do background checks?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
That could be controversial, like in rural areas, you know, because of kind of, you know, do you keep any sort of a loophole for like a father
right.
selling a gun to his son? Right. You know,
well,
that's.
Yeah, but Manchin Toomey tried to thread that needle.
Yeah.
So you could do that. You're always for
immigration reform
right.
already.
Right. You'd be a free trader, which appeals to a certain kind of Democrat.
Right. And so, like, I'm pro-life, but I think I think there's a way to talk about that.
Right.
So.
Well, the way Democrats talk about it is I'm personally pro-life, but I'm for Roe v. Wade, which you wouldn't do.
Well, I think one thing you could say is, I think there's a way to basically say, like, I don't think that Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned anytime soon, but I'll tell you what I would. Before right now is a 20-week ban.
Yeah, you would never get out of a Democratic primary with that.
I think that's perfectly
what you could do. I forget we mentioned this on the show before. I wish there were more Republican Kirk Cameron conservatives when it comes to abortion. And by that I mean if do you ever watch the movie Listen to Me?
I've not.
Oh, you should see Listen to Me. Listen to Me as the quintessential late 80s. Debate movie about college debate.
Oh, I've been to a date movie. I've never been to a debate movie.
So Kirk Cameron is the plucky conservative from Oklahoma who's paired up with this haughty liberal from somewhere, and they're representing the small scrappy college going up against Harvard in front of the national debate championships where the Supreme Court are the judges of the debate, and they have to debate abortion in the final scene. So spoiler people, I'm going to give drop
okay.
spoilers. they have to take the anti-abortion view, Kirk Cameron's team. And at the very last minute, he comes up with a brilliant solution, which is to reduce the number of abortions with a national program promoting comprehensive sex ed and contraception. And then with that, they beat Harvard. So I don't know where you are on those sorts of issues, those sort of contraception issues and absence education type issues. But if you were more liberal on those things, and you didn't get into the 20-week abortion ban stuff. You were like, I'm a reduced abortion person. Look, 20-week abortion ban, I might be for it, but the Supreme Court's never going to do it. We can find the common ground to
all
reduce
right.
the number
it's
of
set.
Abortions.
No, it's set. Now, step one, we need to scrub the DMZ library of any past statements I may have said. Step two, clearly I'm running as a conservative Democrat in 2018 in the midterms. Where do I move? Who do I Bigfoot?
What's hard for you is that some of your positions are good for a rural conservative Democrat, but other positions are better for an upscale, wealthy, you know, college educated, moderate Democrat.
So yes, I kind of piss off both sides.
Yeah, so there's not a perfect district for you, I don't think. Although, I mean, maybe Pennsylvania 18, because I do think that suburban Pittsburgh area is different than the more rural, farther west areas.
Another missed opportunity, Bill. I'm just going to have to keep cashing my big checks in the media.
We probably should wrap it up on that note, sir.
All right. Well, we covered a lot of ground today.
You changed parties in this show, which is a seminal moment.
I'm now a conservative Democrat.
But you haven't changed your registration.
Well, no. See, I'm not. First of all, I don't. When people call me Republican, I don't complain about it because that's sort of petty. But I have never. I always consider myself more of a conservative than a right. Republican.
Right.
Number one. And number two, I've lived in Virginia for the better part of 15 years. Virginia doesn't have registration. Mm. So I'm not registered as a Republican.
So you're not a registered Republican. We have something to jointly plug. I have interviewed you, Matt Lewis.
When's this going to drop?
I think it's going to drop tomorrow, Friday. I'm starting a podcast as part of the New Books Network podcast empire, which they have a slew of podcasts about new books in almost every conceivable subject matter. I'm starting a new channel for them, New Books and Politics, and my inaugural guest will be Matt Lewis talking about Too Dumb to Fail. So check that out, I believe, Friday, and subscribe to the channel. And what else do you have going on, Matt?
Oh, just check out my latest column at the Daily Beast on PA18. Check out the podcast, Matt Lewis in the News. And, again, if you haven't checked them out yet, really good ones recently with Michael Steele, Joe Trippi, and the authors of Why Democracies Die.
Oh, and you, as you plugged recently, you had a podcast with Larry Kudlow, who's now Trump's new top economic advisor. You have that in your archives.
Yeah, no, I interviewed him in December of 2016, so right after Trump won the election, and he had a book out about how Reagan and JFK write about taxes. But the last half of the podcast, we spent a lot of time talking about Trump's economic policies, including tariffs, which Kudlow disagrees with him about. So yeah, basically, Kudlow and Gary Cohn essentially are the same in many ways.
Right. But the only logic of this switch is that Kudlow has been on TV, and I like people who are on TV.
I like people who are on TV too. I think that as we see Trump coming now to where he's going to – like, okay, another example would be Bolton. I mean, I know that Bolton actually has experience in diplomacy, but
That's generous.
But he's also a TV guy, right?
Right.
So I think that, like, if we look at Bolton, if we look at Kudlow and the direction that Trump's going to go in – with his administration, I suspect we're going to see more TV pundits in the, you know, in the cabinet and whatnot.
Something to look forward to.
Yes, my friend, another right. award-winning episode.
So we'll catch you next week here on the DMZ.
All right. See ya.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.